So when Boris asked me to give a lunch talk, I started thinking that this is really a one-hour adaptation of 4 hours of lectures, or more than 4 hours, about 7 hours or 8 hours of lectures I gave on these topics. And the way you attract people to come to these lectures is you title it Sex, Food, Lifespan, and Stress. But what, and I will talk about every one of those things if I have enough time. But what I'm really interested in is the connections between those four. We have a group of people who study evolution here, be it stellar evolution or be it evolution of all living organisms, and these are rather clearly heavy selection pressures that are put on organisms to evolve, some of which give genetic diversity to the pool of organisms, some of which are absolutely essential. And all four of these act, all four of those forces which really act on evolution, act at many levels on living organisms. They certainly, although 20th century evolutionists didn't believe that there was selection on populations, there almost surely is selection on populations for various traits. And so these act on populations, and they act on the organism in a population. They act at the cellular level, and they act at the molecular level. And if I have enough time, I'm going to give three examples of the interconnections between these. So when you have forces acting on evolution, those forces have their impacts upon changing the genes and the functions of the genes and the proteins that are made, and as such, networks are built up that, in fact, respond and control each of these four things. And those networks have interconnections, and they communicate with each other. And I'm going to stress the communication between networks that act on these four forces, right? So that's the goal. And I'm going to tell you three experiments, only one of which right at the end did we participate in. The first experiment will be about Drosophila, but it's been, certainly done in Drosophila a couple of times. And it will address populations and organisms, and it will relate procreation and lifespan in an interesting way. And then the second experiment I'm going to tell you about was actually first done in Philadelphia by a guy named Hayflick, who was then at Stanford, then went to Stanford. And that's going to relate cellular and molecular mechanisms, and it's going to be have something to do with longevity, stress, food, and there's no sex in that one at all. And then the third, which is probably most inclusive, I want to just bring in something that's really happened for the last 10 years or so, where organismic longevity has been studied in great detail. Signal transduction pathways have been found to play big roles in longevity, giving the organism two or even in some cases threefold increases in longevity due to mutations and signal transduction pathways. And that uncovered the fact that food played a big role in it. In human terms, diabetes is modulated by these pathways, so lifespan and food. And one of the things we study, my lab studies, is stress, and the impact of stress upon those signal transduction pathways is beginning to be understood as an integrating factor. Okay, so I hope that outlines where I'm going to go. So let me just start by describing an experiment that has its origins actually about 100 years ago. Morgan at Columbia University made the decision that he was studying genetics, and they had rediscovered Mendel and Mendelian genetics, and Morgan made the decision that Drosophila was in fact a really good organism to breed, that within a two-week, three-week period, you could actually turn over generations, that the organism was complex enough to be interesting. His first mutant came in eye color. He had white eye, where the wild type is red eye. And he began to realize that this was a terrific way in which very rapidly to study genetics. And out of that group, little group that he assembled at Columbia came recombination, came linkage maps, came a whole bunch of things which in the 10-year period was an extraordinary groundwork, cornerstone really of genetics that we understand today. And Morgan very naturally wanted to turn over generations rapidly. So the very first thing he did when he wanted to study fruit flies is he went out to the wild and captured some fruit flies, so they're quite outbred, although they're all same species, Drosophila melanogaster. And he mated them as rapidly as possible in the lab. So within a week after the fly is mature, sexually, the fly is born as a fly, comes out of the larval stages as a fly, they're sexually mature, and he mated them within the first week of life. And then they had eggs, and the eggs grew up, and then he got the progeny, and he mated them again within the first week of life. And all Drosophila geneticists liked that so much because you could turn over generations, that that was, the, in effect, I don't think they realized that at the time, the selection pressure they put on the fly. The selection pressure they put on the fly was rapid generation time, rapid mating. It would be the rough equivalent of mating 13 and 14-year-olds in the human population every generation, so that you end up, if you can, if there's allelic differences that between the in the population that would optimize mating time, you'd optimize the individual for mating at that time, right? Correct. And some of his flies failed, and the penalty for failure is you're no longer in the game, right? Okay, that's Darwinian failure, right? Okay, so when they did that, that was de rigueur. So when you were decided to work on Drosophila, you always mated them in that way. Right? Now, though nobody really appreciated that, he had optimized for early fertilization. And the lifespan of those flies is about 2.5 to 3 weeks. So there's a, and they die in a Gamperpian way, that is to say, people who in the insurance companies know this curve very, very well. If this is the percentage of live individuals in a cohort, now I'm going to define a cohort as a group of people within a 10-year period of birth, right, or a 5-year period of birth. Doesn't really matter. And we watch them through life, and then this is life, so this is time, right? The standard curve for all organisms looks like that, right? In fact, I have to try to draw more accurately because I don't have slides. It goes down slightly. In fact, if I drew this at the beginning of the 20th century, there'd be a much more rapid death at birth because due to infectious diseases and so forth. But by today, when there's pretty good, the slope down here is very shallow, then there's a period of time where a large percentage of the population dies. And then there's these centenarians, people that live to 90, 100, 110 years old that are out here. And this curve actually is remarkable. It's the curve that you would get whether you take a cohort from yeast, from flies, from worms, or from humans. This is the curve in the equation that you would get. And this is a rather standard curve. So if I take, now I can take 50% of the organisms. In Drosophila, this is 2.5 to 3 weeks. That's Morgan's Drosophila, right? So then people said, well, suppose I wanted to mate the flies later. Is that possible? Fly, after all, lives 3 weeks. Suppose I wanted to mate them at 2.5 weeks. Is that possible? And so in order to get good alleles from the population, these are pretty inbred flies by the time they're passed in the laboratory, they went out to the wild environment again, they caught flies, and instead of mating them at 1 week, they mated them at 2.5 weeks. And they kept mating them, and they kept mating them, and they kept mating. They went through about 10 generations mating flies at about 2.5 weeks instead of at 1 week, and then the Gamperpian curves look like that. So on the average, selecting for later age at which you mate and get flies over a 10 to 12 generation period gave rise to about 2x increase in lifespan. Right? That's the unselected marker, if you will. Right? Now, that's been repeated a number of times, and it's real. You can't do this with inbred flies because they lose the alleles. They lose the diversity. Right? But you can do it when you go out to the wild and you put it in. And it says something very fundamental that is in some ways very obvious in retrospect. And that is, there's quite a relationship between mating time, maturity of mating, and lifespan, right? And there has to be an evolution, because the last thing you want is to become sexually mature after you die, right? Right? So that's why I said it's kind of obvious, but it comes with a nice story. Yet there has to be some relationship between sexual maturity and lifespan, but that those relationships are linked, so that when you move lifespan sexual activity to a later age, you actually live longer on the average. Why? Because you're optimizing different alleles. Yeah. Yeah.
Why was it true that after a whole bunch of those flies died?
They probably did at the beginning.
The ones that made it had some strength to live long.
No. What's happening is you're selecting. What's happening here is not that. It is true that you could. I think you're asking a slightly different question. If not, I'll answer it anyhow. It is true that we do have a fixed longevity, so that because you have to pass on to leave enough resources for your offspring. If you don't, your offspring are in trouble. So that is often thought in evolutionary terms as the raison d'etre for longevity, right? Having said that, that's not the case here. What's happening is you're reassorting a collection of alleles to optimize for reproduction at 2.5 weeks instead of 1 week. And when you optimize that, that's why it takes about 10, 12 generations, when you optimize that, you also coordinately select for, that's the unselected marker, right, longevity. So I'm not answering your question then. What were you asking?
No. In fact, by waiting until 2.5 weeks instead of 1 week, you were selecting for longevity.
Correct. No. Everybody, so at 2.5 weeks, you might be here, right, normally. So you're not really selecting for longevity.
It's
carrying an allele. It always had the gene, but it's carrying an allele. Right, and so the fact that you're when you get to the molecular explanation of this, you'll see that the alleles are almost the same. That the genes I'm talking about that confer longevity are the genes that get signals from sexual reproduction system. Right, so you're not just simply doing five selections simultaneously. You're actually acting on the same set of genes. Okay, well, I'm not getting to you, so yeah, I'll go to someone else, yeah.
If I look at the flies that had one set of baby flies and another set of baby flies, on average, do the second set live longer? So is it transmissible?
No, this is not like acquired characteristics in the giraffe that stretched its neck.
No, but by having children later,
yes.
On average, you select for longer lived flies.
No, not in a generation. This took 10 generations to optimize alleles in a signal transduction pathway so that you got longevity, right? Yes, of course it breeds. Well, it happened. Oh, well, so he's not asking that.
Okay.
Let me.
Is there a collection of genes?
Yeah, I think you could debate this, but I have a feeling we're not debating on the same level here. I'll get back to the molecular explanation of this, and it'll become clearer when I talk about the molecular explanation. I just wanted to get you through the phenotype. That what that related was time of procreation to lifespan. Right? If you want to be very anthropomorphic about it, today's couples, right, are having children at later age on the average. If we do that, continue that for 10, 20 generations, presumably that will flow into a longer lifespan in humans, right? Mm-hmm. Because we would be selecting alleles which optimize for late procreation. So there's a good example. You could have babies at 35, right, when nobody's really dead. Here you are at 35, and if you did that, right, you would hopefully extend lifespan in humans. It hasn't been done with humans, but... Yeah.
This is a minor technical question. I'm not quite sure what you mean by alleles.
I mean two forms of the same gene. An allele is just two forms, long-lived, short-lived. That would be an allele. At the molecular level, that might be a G and a C, right? So in the same gene. Right?
Does this involve a later sexual maturity?
It often goes with later sexual maturity, something that we're seeing in the human population, or actually we're seeing earlier sexual maturity. But sexual maturity can change. That's a variable that's genetically controlled. And I want to just leave you, if I haven't explained to everybody, I just want to leave you with the following feeling, right? And that is that many of these things are genetically controlled. You certainly can be hit by a bus and go down this and bring the curve down, but we're talking about things which are strongly genetically controlled. And you'll see more and more coordinate. Okay, so that's at the organismic level, and it's also at the individual level, and it relates procreation with lifespan. Now, if we switch quickly, I'm going to keep moving down in structure. If we switch to the cellular level, then there was an experiment done in the 1950s by a guy named Hayflick. So I just want to set the feeling for you of the 1950s in biology. In the field is cancer biology, of all things. In the 1950s, and what we really wanted to do was to make cell lines of mammalian cells, human cells, that could grow in tissue culture. Right? Vaccines were being made. They wanted to grow vaccines in human cells and monkey cells. There were lots of activity, and the human was, and the mouse were often thought of as two complex experimental organisms. Could we take their cells and put them in a petri dish and grow them? Right? And a couple of rules came out. If a person had a cancer, I could take the cancer cells out, put them in a petri dish, and by and large, not all the time, but many times, they grow forever in culture. Right? And we say that's immortal. They have immortality. But if I did that with normal cells, they were not immortal. They would not grow forever. And this is the so-called Hayflick experiment. So what Hayflick did was to take cells from a newborn. And in fact, most commonly you'd take foreskin fibroblasts, so it'd be male. And what you would do is you'd start passaging them in culture under very rich nutrient conditions. So the cells should be very happy. In fact, you used serum from people or pregnant horses or pregnant cows. You just put in everything you possibly could to keep these cells happy, all the nutrients, and you plotted the number of generations versus the generation time. Right? So that was his standard plot. And on the average, the generation time of cells from a newborn, from fibroblasts, was about 24 hours. So that's 24-hour point. And then you just counted the number of generations they went through, and they did pretty well for a while, and then they stopped. They went to an infinite generation time, or they stopped. Right? Now, this was quite reproducible, and several things made it kind of interesting. Right? I don't want to be anthropomorphic here, but if we take the youngest person in the room and we take a biopsy from her and put it in culture, right? This is a thought experiment, as the physicists say, right? She would have a curve that looks like that. But if you take the same cells from me, right, my curve, I'm older than her, would look like that, right? So this clock of the number of generations is not only a tissue culture artifact, it's actually on in people, this clock. Right? That was the first thing of terrific interest. In fact, I could take cells from human beings who, let's say, live 70 years, Galapagos turtles who live 200 years, and mice that live on the average 2.5 years, and the number of divisions they'd go through was roughly, not exactly, but roughly proportional to the lifespan of the organism. Right? So this clock was not only going on in time, chronological time in an organism, but it was going on in evolutionary time in different organisms and somehow correlated with lifespan, right? So this was often called the Hayflick limit, right? And the next question that became interesting was, if this is in an infinite generation time, what are these cells like, right? Those cells came to be called senescent cells, and the process of going into senescence is in fact known to occur in people. It's one of the major defenses, in fact, against cancer. and the process of going into senescence has gotten better and better understood. These cells are metabolizing fine. They take up glucose at a pretty high rate. They use oxidative phosphorylation to generate ATP. They're processing their glucose in a normal fashion. They're slightly anaerobic, so they use glycolysis a little bit more than oxidative phosphorylation. But other than that, their maintenance capabilities are terrific. Right? And that's true in cell culture. In human beings, the cells, when they exist, when you can see them, and actually don't last very long in the body. And the reason is, among the products they produce, senescent cells, are cytokines, which are proteins that attract immune cells in. For the cognoscenti, they attract neutrophils or macrophages into the body, into the region of senescent cells, and they're phagocytized and they're killed. So senescent cells are cleaned up in the body, but they are, in fact, a major mechanism by which certain cancers are stopped and eliminated by the immune system. And this senescence, right, this process of senescence, happens in vivo and in vitro. I'm going to tell you in a minute, a few minutes, the molecular reason for that. However, at the time, since we knew cancer cells, so if I did cancer cells look like that, right? What would happen if I put in a virus that causes cancer here, right? Well, a common virus that was used was named SV40, right? And what happened was that a few of these cells came back and they started to grow at 24 hours. So it was possible to overcome this block by oncogenes, genes that cause cancer from viruses. However, all hell broke loose again, and a second wave of high generation time and death. Right? So the first wave is senescence. The second wave is death now ensues. And the second wave of death, right, all the cells, or many of the cells, die. A rare cell that didn't die comes out of this and grows on forever and is truly immortal. Right? Just like a cancer cell. Okay, so that's the observations. There, this clock is on in you. This clock maybe has something to do, people often thought it has something to do with lifespan, right? Because old and young people, when they're looked at, have different number of divisions they go through. It certainly has something to do with metabolism. It has a lot to do with stress, as you'll see in a little while. Okay, so this Hayflick experiment was really intriguing and mostly enigmatic until the next Hayflick's in the 1950s, until the next 40 years of research uncovered the mechanisms that are involved. So when these cells undergo senescence, right, they are in the G1 phase of the cell cycle. Now I have to go slowly for those who might not know. So is anybody in trouble if I say G1 phase of the cell cycle? Sorry. This would be a good time to leave. only two alternatives, yeah. Okay. So when cells divide, actually at the beginning of watching cells divide, if you look in a microscope, you notice that there's two times that you can tell that the cells look different. One is when they're synthesizing their DNA. They're doubling their DNA content. And that's often called S phase for synthesis. And the other is when they divide. And that's called M phase for mitosis. Right? And so if I look at a cell cycle, right, I see that there is an S phase. There's a time at which DNA is synthesized. And there is a mitosis phase. There's a time for mitosis. In fact, remarkably, S phase hardly varies in time.
You have to explain mitosis to
yourself. Mitosis is just the separation of chromosomes into two cells. It's the process by which chromosomes segregate, and when they segregate abnormally, you got problems, right? Trisomy 21 is Down syndrome, an improper segregation of chromosome 21. Right? So mitosis occurs within a time, usually an hour and a half. S phase occurs within a time, usually 6 to 8 hours. Right, and then no one quite knew what happened between mitosis and S phase, and so that was called G1, and no one quite knew what happened to S phase and M phase, and that was called G2, and the terms are GAP1 and GAP2. Right, all right. So that gave it a name, but didn't really help. right? So senescent cells are in G1, right? There is a way to exit the cell cycle and be out of the cell cycle forever. One exit I just told you about is senescence, and another exit is often called G0. And these exits are, in fact, quiescent long periods of time. Your neurons, I don't mean this personally, but your neurons are in this quiescent phase. They no longer divide, they're in G1. However, many cells in your liver take their pause in G2. Right? So that's places where you could pause in what's called the cell cycle, right?
What are the two directions going?
You only go in one direction. It's if you can't go backwards, it's unlike the physics equations, right? There's only one direction, right? Yeah. All right. So these senescent cells are in G1. What? What goes around is one cell turns into two cells. Right? So you go from, in G1 you build up the mass of the cell. The major part of G1 is to build up the mass, protein synthesis, it senses nutrients. I'm actually going to get to all this, but it's a good thing to introduce. You're sensing the nutrients. G1 is a stage in which you sense that everything is ready to go and you build up all the reserves to go. Because I could take cells that have passed a point in G1 called the restriction point, right? And if you're past the restriction point, I can take you out of all nutrient possibilities, right? No more glucose, no more amino acids, no more fatty acids, no more serum, and you finish the cycle, right? So G1 is the stage at which you prepare to go through S phase, G2, and M. And S phase is, of course, the doubling of the chromosomes. G2 is the proper condensation of the chromosomes from a replicative phase to a chromosome condensation phase. And M is that literally the separation of your 23 chromosomes, 46 chromosomes. Right. Okay, so the point, of course, is senescent cells are in G1. So now I want to become molecular, right? So I'm going to start using what is going to appear to be an appalling jargon to people who are not used to it, and I apologize, it's just the jargon of the field. I'm happy to stop at any point, but I can always trim the talk down. All right, so what happens in G1 is a time, right? And it's quite a variable time, because it's a time to sense nutrients, right? So that relates this to food. And you've got to have enough glucose, and you've got to have enough high rate of protein synthesis. We heard this morning about the ribosome biogenesis, right? Ribosomes are the factories that make protein. They are made out of 75 different proteins and 4 RNA molecules. And the assembly of ribosomes gives mass to the cells. You have millions of ribosomes that are factories to make proteins. All of that is building up with time here. And when it reaches a crucial level at which it functions, it's functional, and can carry through the rest of the cycle into S phase, it triggers the S phase. And that's the so-called restriction point that I told you about. Now, what happened a while ago, worth a Nobel Prize in biology, was that these timing events in the cell cycle were shown to be due mainly to the synthesis of, in a cyclical fashion, of particular proteins which then came to be called cyclins. They're called cyclins because they cycle, right? And they are the things that control timing. So if I looked at a cyclin, a particular cyclin, it would go up, and then it would crash at a certain time. And this is called cyclin D1. And so what cyclin D1s are a subunit of a dimer of a protein that activate the other protein. And the other protein's a protein kinase, and the protein, there are two of them here, called CDK, cyclin-dependent kinases 4 and 6. Right? So I'm going to now start to need some space. So I have D, CDK, 4 and 6, whose concentration, when it hits the right concentration, measures mass. It's a way to measure mass. Its concentration, bang, triggers you into the cell cycle. Right? Go, no go. If the cyclin gets trashed at any time, prematurely stop the cell progression of the cell cycle, reset, right? So this cyclin is absolutely essential to get through the G1 phase of the cell cycle and into S phase. And it's a way to measure mass. It's an indirect way to measure mass. Now, the cyclin actually is a protein kinase, I've told you. So it adds a phosphate group to another protein. And the other protein it adds a phosphate group to has been called the retinoblastoma protein. It gets the name because when it's missing, children get retinoblastomas. That's cancer of the eye. Right? Now, that this has something to do with cancer is evident by the fact that about 13% of breast cancers amplify the cyclin D gene. What would happen if you amplified the cyclin G gene is you make too much cyclin D, you never stop. You just keep going around the cycle and growth is... So here we've got an oncogene, and here we've got the oncogene phosphorylating this retinoblastoma protein. Right? Now, the retinoblastoma protein is that restriction point I told you about. And the reason it's a restriction point is it's bound to two other proteins, sorry for the jargon, called E2F DP1. Right? Now, what these are simply transcription factors. Right? What are transcription factors? They're proteins that bind to DNA at many genes, and they turn the genes on for transcription. So this is a neat way. This retinoblastoma, that's an inhibition sign, inhibits these when it's bound. In fact, these are on the DNA all the time. So they sit there on the DNA. But when the retinoblastoma protein is bound to them on the DNA, they don't function. The phosphorylation event takes the retinoblastoma protein off, and now they function. And what do? They transcribe hundreds of genes which move the cell from G1 to S phase. Okay? So that's great. Here we have a rather simple signal transduction pathway. And this restriction point, the RB gene, prevents entry into the cell cycle. And this, cyclin D, promotes entry into the cell cycle. Amplification, I told you, of cyclin D causes cancer in breast cancers and is called an oncogene because it positively causes cancers. Retinoblastoma, the loss of function of retinoblastoma, because if you have a mutated retinoblastoma, prevents cancer. Why? Because it blocks this entry into S phase. When you lose it by mutation, you've lost the tumor suppressor gene. Right? There's a negative regulator of a cancer, a positive regulator of a cancer. Right? You can see that this works as a nice switch on the cell cycle.
How conservative is that? I mean, this is in human
that's starting up,
right?
Yeah, it's human, mouse, actually Drosophila worms, not yeast, yep. not yeast. I'm going to make a big distinction if I ever get to the third part between the way yeast regulate the cell cycle. I'll just tell you so you know, yeast are go no go. This is a go no go signal, right? For entry into the cycle. Yeast are go-no-go based on nutrients alone. Give them glucose, give them amino acids, give them a little vitamins, bang, they're off, right? That's go-no-go. Mammalian cells have two signals. They must have nutrients, but they must have mitogens. Mitogens. Mitogens are proteins which signal for division. They signal in trance. They could be made in your pituitary and then... good mitogen is insulin. Could be made in your pancreas in response to glucose, trigger the cell to go into the cell cycle. Right? Yeast don't have that. And that's a very big signaling difference between them. All right, so here's a nice simple system. And why did I bring it up? Because I have got to bring you back to senescence. What happens in senescence is that this is inhibited by a protein called P16, which is a negative regulator of cyclin D CDK4. And when you look at these cells that are in senescence, P16 levels are sky high. Right? So what happens if I follow it? P16, I have another color, yeah. So now you can see what's happening. Something's regulating P16 with each division, and it's rising to a crescendo, blocking the function, not the synthesis, but the function of cyclin D CDK4, blocking the entry into S phase. And that's senescence, right? Now, again, I'm going to take a small deviation for those who are cognizant of what the genome looks like, because that's a kind of interesting locus, this P16 locus. So a locus is a couple of genes, right? And the locus is called INC4A, right? Why is it called INC4A? Inhibitor of protein kinase 4A. This is the inhibitor of this protein kinase, right? The locus is made up of four exons, right? And that four exons make two proteins. It's one of the almost one of the only regions in the human genome, but the mouse genome also, and a few other genomes, almost only the region which has information in two reading frames. Right. So information in two reading frames is really dangerous because a single mutation changes two proteins simultaneously, or can. Right. But that, for some reason, this evolved that way. And one of the proteins, which I'm going to tell you about, does this. And the other protein does this. This is the messenger RNA. Here's the splices. Right. Here's the messenger RNA, here's the splices, and here's the protein, right? So one of the proteins uses these three exons in reading frame one and makes the protein P16 that I just told you about, right? Another one picks up a fresh new exon at the amino terminal of the protein, comes in at a reading frame to exon one for this gene, right? And continues at a reading frame here, and this makes a protein called P19R. Again, I really apologize for the jargon, but there's almost no other way to live with this. The jargon is not systematic because these things are all discovered over different time frames in different labs by people who think they're all different, but then they get synthesized together. There's a frame shift between them, rather reading frames. So here's a piece of DNA that a single mutation would cause a change here and a change here, two proteins, right? The proteins don't share sequence information because they're all out of reading frame, right? Okay. Now, INC4A is one of the major loci in cancer. It's really a big player. In fact, I think it and one other gene I'll tell you about in a minute are mutated in maybe 50, 60, 70%, maybe 100% of all cancers, right? And one of the reasons is the senescence. If you're mutating P16, you don't go into senescence, right? You don't go into senescence. You've lost one of your defenses against continued replication forever, right? Okay. I'll tell you about P19R in a minute when we bring in stress. Okay. So that helps explain this, right? And in fact, there are lots of interesting experiments. I'll just tell you. Thea Tilsey, who's at UCSF, can go and look in the breast of normal breast tissue of a woman who's had reduction mammoplasty. And she looks at this genetic locus, right? And in 1 in 10,000 cells in a normal breast, there's heavy methylation of this locus, which is a signal that it doesn't express. Right? A latent cancer, it's not cancerous, but a latent cancer cell which can't go into senescence, right? Precursor to cancer. Right? So one now has a sort of map on these kinds of things by understanding this signal transduction pathway. This is senescence is aging, senescence is food, and so forth. All right, now, what's happening here is when you infect with a virus, you eliminate P16 function, and the cells rapidly go back into cell cycle, and they divide 10 more times, but then they crash again. Right? And this time, they're not crashing in senescence, they're crashing in death. Right? And that means there's a second fail-safe to this division process. These are really fail-safes. So when worms and flies are born, they're mostly born, not entirely, but mostly born post-mitotic. That is to say, except for the germline, there aren't too many dividing cells after you get a full-blown worm or a full-blown fly. But their strategy is to be born fully formed, and the only really heavy division goes on in the germline. Our strategy is totally different. Our strategy is to constantly regenerate ourselves. So every day, in every person here, 1 billion new cells are born. And every day they're born in the skin, they're born in your bone marrow, they're born in your intestine, and you're constantly replacing yourself. And I presume that gives you some 70 years or 80 years of life by constantly regenerating yourself. Right? That's frequently done by what people believe are stem cells. Stem cells would be the cells that have asymmetric division properties. They regenerate themselves and make another stem cell, but then they differentiate into skin or intestine. Right? But you're at risk, obviously, to have that go wild. And if it does go wild, then cancer is a problem. So you have two fail-safes against it. The first is senescence. With time, your stem cells build up P16, and they stop the process, and you go into senescence. So this is a good example of a senescent pathway, right? Right here, P16. If this is shut down, you've lost the senescence. You go 10 more divisions, and then you stop again, and you die at an alarming rate. So literally, all the cells in the petri dish now are dying. They're no longer sitting there and metabolizing, they're dying. It's death, right? And the reason for that death is that the genome becomes completely unstable. Your chromosomes are unstable. And the reason they're unstable is found out over many years is due to the fact that when you replicate DNA, you can only replicate it in one direction, what's so-called 5' to 3' direction. And you require a little primer to do the replication. The primer's not DNA. So it's erased at the end. And that means the ends of your chromosomes get shorter and shorter and shorter with each division, with each replication cycle, right? And those are called telomeres. And when telomeres get too short, they leave fragmented ends at the chromosome, and these fragmented ends recombine and make fusions out of your chromosomes. When that happens, you're scrambling information at an alarming rate, and most of the cells die. Right? You just can't maintain the information content of these chromosomes in such a disordered and disjunction way. You've lost genomic stability, and you've created genomic instability. Right? And these cells. Actually, I presume that this timing is so that you get two shots at life, right?
I'm just asking, like, why does that mechanism describe the genomic mechanism?
Different. Okay.
Stage one.
Right.
Is that operative all the time, or is it?
Oh, it is operative under stress. Yeah. So what this second step is stress, right? When the cell sees that its ends are a mess, it is the exact equivalent of radiation damage. So if I took gamma radiation, I made single and double stranded breaks in the DNA, that would be the same thing. And you have a normal stress response to that. You shut down progression through the cell cycle. And in this case, when your telomeres are too short, you see that as, and you shut it down, right?
Normally, just go into senescence before that ever becomes senescent.
Yes, you would. So the senescence is actually interesting because it's counting about 10 generations before you go too far. We don't understand that count, right? But we note that there's an order to it. It's another one of those great constants here, right? So, what is the stress signal, right? The stress signal is single and double stranded breaks in DNA. Right. And what responds to it? Well, like anything else, there are detectors. Right? Then there are proteins that signal. Right? And then there's a hub, that's going to shut down the whole cell cycle in response to the stress. And that protein is P53. Right? It was found first as a protein of a molecular weight of 53,000, so that's why it got its name. But it's signaled to by a protein kinase, which sits on the lesion. Name of the protein kinase, for those who care, is called ATM. And in signaling to P53, P53 senses all kinds of stress, right? And it shuts down the cell cycle, right? Now, it has its own particular ways of shutting down the cell cycle, and I'll talk about that in the next 10 minutes. How much, where's Boris? How much time, Boris? What do you think?
15?
Okay. I see you're not in control here, Boris. It's quite clear. Okay, so so what we have here, let's say, how do I want to do this? Okay, so what P53 does here, right, is it has three possible outcomes. Here, right? One outcome is apoptosis. One outcome is senescence. And one outcome is cell cycle arrest. Right. Now, so the input, the stress signal is DNA damage. The output is, let's say, cell death. That'll make it simple, right? So anytime a cell comes along that is in this extreme condition of having genomic instability, it's being killed by P53. And P53 is a transcription factor, so it turns on a whole set of genes, literally hundreds of genes, which program it into the apoptotic pathway. Right? So it's the second failsafe. Right? So as you might guess, 50% of all cancers have mutations in the P53 gene. Right? You've lost your stress response. The other thing that's very strange, I think that no one really has any deep appreciation for, is the diversity of stress signals that trigger P53. I've just told you about DNA damage, but starvation for glucose triggers stress. Right? Interesting guy. Hypoxia, not enough oxygen, triggers stress. The failure of ribosomes to be made, ribosome biogenesis, triggers stress. So if I stop ribosome synthesis, I shut the cell cycle down completely, usually through senescence or cell cycle arrest. Not apoptosis in that case. There are literally 10 or 12 different stress signals which all feed into the same central node in the signal transduction pathway, and that node is being triggered here by telomere destruction, right? Just a sec. So one of the things that this then relates, obviously, is stress, right? Lifespan, right? There's no sex in cell culture, I don't think, right? But it has relation to food, okay? Now, I want to tell you about the third signal transduction pathway. I'm going to abbreviate it because of time, so please, those of you who know all about it, forgive me for the abbreviations, but let's start with P53. I'm going to have to put some things in. I'm just going to draw a set of signal transduction pathways at the molecular level, not tell you how we know about them, but there's good genetic evidence for it, good biochemical evidence, and so forth. So we have stress, and I told you there's a detector and there's a mediator of stress, and that signals to P53, whose output, let's say, is apoptosis. That's cell death, right? And you use this all the time. So you've all eaten lunch, right? So you have some crap in your food, right? And in your intestine, it causes mutations. And these mutations break DNA or make adducts in DNA. That's repaired by and large. When it's not repaired, P53 senses it hasn't been repaired properly, and it kills your cell. You go outside. You can't do this today, but you go outside here in California, and you get a sunburn, DNA damage. P53-mediated apoptosis is the skin coming off, right? You're peeling. Right? Why? Because you're killing cells that have DNA damage. The last thing in the world you want to do is replicate a cell with DNA damage. The mutation rate goes up 1,000-fold. Right? You lose information transfer if you try to replicate a damaged template. Right? And that's what this whole signaling is about. Now, P53 is actually regulated in a negative way by a gene called MDM2. Which is, again, for the cognoscenti, a ubiquitin ligase. It puts a small peptide on P53. You put these peptides on, and it trashes it, and it's degraded. Okay? So actually, the stress signals actually come in here, inhibit the ligase, and P53 levels go up. Now, that's really good strategy, right? If I damage your DNA, the last thing you want to do is transcribe it. Right? And this is not transcribing it. I've damaged your DNA. The signal is a protein kinase. It activates it inhibits MDM2, and the half-life of the protein that existed goes up. Right? No transcription at all, just response to damage rapidly. It's fast. The half-life of P53 is anywhere between 3 minutes and 20 minutes, and so the half-life raises rapidly. P53 is a transcription factor, so it's here. P19ARF. Right, is an inhibitor of MDM2. Right, that's the second thing in the locus here. Right, this thing out of right. So the locus actually is coordinating stress, right, with stress and responses here with cell cycle arrest. P16 and P19 bring these two cycles together in the INC4A locus. Right? And we'll get to that in a minute, but I just want to now go back to the question I answered with you that was different in yeast. So in yeast, the go-no-go signal is, what's the nutrient environment? If it's rich, I go. I'm into the cell cycle. If it's poor, I don't go. In mammalian cells, it's not that way. You could have very rich environment, but you also need another protein which engages a receptor that turns on the cell cycle. And that's called the mitogen signal. So you need a mitogen and nutrients. And that's a coordinated set of signals. And one of the major pathways that does that is called the insulin-like growth factor pathway. Right? And one of the major pathways that senses nutrients, so this is glucose, amino acids it senses, right, is a pathway called the TOR pathway. TOR is a protein kinase. Insulin-like growth factor is a soluble protein, right? So let's start with TOR. Let's start with insulin-like growth factor. This is the mitogen. It hits a receptor. The receptor is on the membrane of the cell. So when you see glucose, you secrete insulin from the pancreas. That insulin works on other tissues to secrete an insulin-like growth factor. So this is a real response to seeing glucose. It's a nutrient sensor, and the nutrient but it produces a mitogen, right? Sensing nutrients and mitogens needs a receptor, right? This receptor actually triggers another protein kinase. Sorry for the jargon. PI3 kinase, which makes a small lipid, a small fat called PIP3. Right? I'm going into this detail for a reason, and that activates a protein kinase called AKT1, which activates a set of transcription factors in the nucleus, right? And this is positive for growth, right? So nice. It's a signal transduction pathway that turns on cell growth. That's its commitment to cell division, right? And that's because times are good and there's a mitogen available, right? So that's good, but this, which senses glucose and amino acids, is actually regulated by this, right? So it turns out AKT, right, regulates two proteins called TSC1, TSC2. Nobody should memorize any of this, right? Which regulates a protein called Rheb. But this is, for those again who want to know, this is a G protein, and this is a GTPase. So this step is an inhibitory step. Right? Inhibitory step. This is a positive step. Right? And this is required for TOR. Right? So there's communication between the mitogen pathway and the glucose pathway through these genes. Right? Just to tell you why I want to bother to tell you about them, this is an oncogene, causes cancer, colon cancer. About 50% of colon cancers have mutations in this gene. Almost all tumors have high levels of this gene. It's an anti-apoptotic protein kinase. Why is it an anti-apoptotic protein kinase? Watch. Because it acts upon MDM2 in a positive fashion, which then inhibits P53. So the signal for growth shuts down the signal for stress, right? So you're shutting down the stopping of the cell cycle when you're committed to the cell cycle, and it's done through that loop. Right? Stress pathway, growth pathway.
Are you talking about proteins each having more than 50% of all tumors having mutations in them?
Yes.
Does it mean that a typical tumor has a mutation in all of them?
No. Well, it means a typical tumor has multiple mutations in multiple genes. Or single mutation. So in colon cancers, there might be 5, 6, or 7 mutations. However, in different colon cancers, in any colon cancer, there may be 5. In different ones, there may be 100 genes that in combinations of 5 act, right? And that's why what I've said is greater than the sum of its parts. Exactly. All right. So now I come in with glucose. There's another guy, AMP kinase, right? Which inhibits this and which senses, the sensor of the glucose is AMP kinase. AMP is the substrate for ATP. That's the energy source. And it is titrating how well the mitochondria is making ATP. When it makes lots of ATP, AMP reduces. AMP reduces, it shuts down this kinase. Right? So that links this back to metabolism, food, right? Back to metabolism, and regulates this pathway. And the final thing to say, for the aficionados, this is a protein kinase that actually regulates not transcription, but translation. So when all things are good, glucose is high, nutrients are signaling like hell, everything's go, it is translating very efficiently proteins that bring oxygen to your cells for oxidative phosphorylation or metabolism that generates high ATP. Right? So aerobic metabolism generates high ATP out of a little glucose. Okay?
Right? Used by doctors to look for
cancer? Yeah. So there are drugs now that inhibit TOR, right? There are drugs that are being developed for PI3 kinase mutations, right? And there's the stress pathway. This is the growth pathway that I showed you. And now I'll end with the pleasant surprise that comes to us from a number of laboratories, mainly working in flies and worms, but has been translated to mice. And not yet to humans. And that is mutations in this pathway that dumb down the pathway increase the longevity of worms and flies and mice. Right? Increase longevity when you dumb down the pathway. Right? That means take the set point and dumb it down. It's probably the reason why caloric restriction works. Right? So I have had no lunch. And that is good because I could live an extra whatever, right? Because I'm going to have lunch after I stop. But so people who are on these rather extreme diets, for some reason those people are always found in California. I don't know why. But people who are on extreme diets, right? These 1,200 calories a day. Right? That's like some maintenance who are just at maintenance, right? They have good nutrients, but
surfboarding,
yeah. They can increase lifespan of rats, of mice, of humans, of monkeys. Not humans. Humans probably, but that hasn't been really tested, right? Monkeys, rats, mice, right? Anybody? Yeast, right? Worms, caloric restriction work, and that's what this does. It dumbs down this path. Mutations dumb down this pathway. Right. So I've managed somehow.
On the fly experiment, did anyone check that it was that pathway?
Yes. So it like we heard this morning, there may be 400 genes that give increased longevity, a subset of which are found in this pathway. That's all you could say, right? No. Yes, and the yeast actually dumbed down another pathway. This pathway, right? But you're right, they don't. And they do it with a protein that is common to worms, flies, and yeast. Right? It's a protein which is called SIRT2. And what it is a DPN HDAC, right? I'll tell you what that is in a second. Right? DPN-DPNH is a product of metabolism. And it's a cofactor for this enzyme to sense the metabolic changes that are going on in the cell. And an HDAC is a protein that changes the chromatin from transcription ability to non-transcription ability and back and forth. Right? So we have intimately the expression of this pathway is regulated by these proteins, and this protein is in yeast, but not this pathway. And so changes in that protein in yeast, which relate it to the pathway, even though it hasn't got it, actually cause yeast to live longer. Living longer in yeast is a relative term, right? I mean, it's a funny, you always thought of yeast as just dividing, but they actually divide asymmetrically. The budding yeast divide asymmetrically. They have a small offspring and a big mother. And the mother only divides 20 times. So that's what they mean by lifespan. She divides more than 20 times. She's got a longer lifespan. Yes? Yes. So finally, when you go out to dinner tonight and order the red wine, there's a small molecule in it called resveratrol, which is thought to act on this pathway and give you better longevity. That's especially believed by the French, I think. And people at Harvard, the two groups that really believe that. Right? In fact, I mean, there's been a very experiment that received a lot of publicity where they made a pill out of resveratrol. They overwhelmed the mouse by giving it 1,000 times or 100 times more of resveratrol than you could drink all of your, any number of bottles that you had to drink to get that much. And the mice lived longer. So, so let me just, I'll finish up by saying, right? Food, lifespan, stress, that all come together. The thing that's quite interesting about sex is that in the worm, where it's really been shown in the nicest way, the gonads and the neurons secrete hormones which affect the activity of this pathway. So there's communication between hormones and gonads and in neurons that have an impact on this pathway. You can demonstrate that by ablation experiments in worms. In humans, it's quite interesting. This gene is estrogen regulated, and this gene is androgen regulated. So there are sex hormones which are regulating these pathways in kind of interesting and a bit unexpected ways. Okay, I managed to do this at about 11 hours worth of lectures in one. So I hope the astrophysicists aren't too blinded by this. Yeah.
In which way are they regulating?
Positively. So premenopausal women who have a form of this, that's in fact what I'll talk about this afternoon. So premenopausal women who have an allelic form of this, that women come, in fact men do too, but women come in two genetic flavors of this gene, right? And one flavor responds to estrogen better than the second flavor. And the one that responds to estrogen raises the level of MDM2 in tissues and lowers the level of stress response. And on the average, for certain kinds of cancers, and in premenopausal women, those women with that flavor of the gene, that allele, will develop cancer at a younger age. Because this is a stress-responding pathway. You're living your life in stress. If it's a weaker pattern, you can divide the group up into weak responses to stress and strong responses, and then you find that those people who have weak responses tend, not infallible, it's a probability, tend to have cancer at a younger age. Yeah?
Type of stress and the type of outcome that you get.
Yeah, so most people when you say stress think of psychological stress, but I don't, there's been no evidence for that. But
DNA damage as opposed to glucose
restriction. Oh, yes, there are very big differences. The nature of the stress and the tissue that the stress occurs to often change what the outcome is, right? So whether it's apoptosis, cell cycle arrest, or senescence will change based on the tissue and based on the nature of the stress, right? But they all filter into a single node, and that node is responding differently to the signals that come in with different outcomes of transcription patterns, right?
How does that fit in this picture that you gave us? For example, if you have stress.
What kind of stress? Hypoxia will... one of the things I didn't say, but I should have. All right. So, yeah. There's a feedback mechanism here. So, this, responding to stress in some tissues, in some situations, like in prostate, induces this protein which degrades that signal. Right? Shuts down this pathway. Right? So if you stress will trump division if it's bad enough. Right? Division trumps stress when this is not signaling. Right? So it's a nice switch between stress and division, and the outcome depends upon the type of stress and the transcriptional program that P53 is rolling out. Apoptosis, G1 arrest, or senescence.
Is there a fundamental trade-off between longevity and risk for cancer?
Yes. So there are mice who have the following properties. You raise the P53 level in the mouse. That's possible to sort of play with this, right? And then you paint a carcinogen on the mouse, and it never gets cancer. But it dies at about...
also the case, for example, for these flies that have...
You know, nobody's done that experiment. But in the mouse, where you raise the level of the stress sensor, right, you essentially all you've done is to make them hypersensitive to the stress. So the two things, the two phenotypes that are seen is cancer resistance, because every time they get a stress that wouldn't trigger you and I, but will trigger them, they knock off the cell. But presumably they're knocking off their stem cells at an alarming rate over a lifetime, and they run out of stem cells, and so therefore they run out of lifespan.
Right, but difficult.
Yes, it's... I like to say it's just what your mother always told you. Live a moderate life, right in the middle. Right? Don't take any of these extremes. Right? Yeah.
So what would the world be about looking for treatments for cancer? It seems like there's a wide diversity of mechanisms, and so it's hard to find something universal to go after these things at the specific level.
Yeah, so every single... I'm going to tell you about the exception in a minute, but every single cancer drug works on a certain percentage of cancer patients, even if they have the same kind of cancer. Colon cancer, lung cancer, right? And that's this diversity that you sense from what I've said. There are some exceptions. All of the leukemias and lymphomas are not due to multiple changes right away. They're due to a single change, and that single change gives you what's called the chronic form of the disease, which you can live with, but it goes acute at some point, and then you would die. So there's a disease called chronic myelogenous leukemia, which is due to a translocation between two genes that turns on a protein kinase. Now, it's not this one. But just to I don't have it up here, but just to show you, if it was the cyclin D protein kinase, you could understand why that would be bad, right? And it's called BCR-ABL, right? And that protein kinase, what Novartis made a drug against the protein kinase, in 99% of people treated with that drug, the disease disappears. Now, unfortunately, like antibiotic resistance, resistance starts to appear because there's high mutation rate in these cancers, right? And then you're never clear, but you control, right? So about 2 to 3% a year, people relapse. So they've done exactly what they've done with antibiotics. They made a second generation drug that attacks the resistant cells, right? And now the race is on, just like antibiotics, to constantly be making drugs that will attack resistant cells. So most people feel now that even the diseases which are favorable to treat, right, are going to have resistance mechanisms like antibiotic mechanisms. And there's going to be this never-ending sort of war between how smart and genetically plastic the cancer is and how smart the people are that are making drugs. Yes?
There's a large number of alleles in humans that predispose towards cancer. And so people that have a predisposing towards cancer allele but survive the cancer,
right,
is it known if those people have extended longevity?
Almost all the mutations I've been talking about are called somatic mutations. They're not in your germline. They are acquired in the tissue, and then they give rise to cancer. We just got a question from Stuart that asked the question, suppose you inherit this. Right? And actually, it's so rare that you only inherit one defect. Right? But when you have one defect, the other one can... what's so-called reduced to homozygosity can disappear in a rare cell, and then you got the problem here. So there's a disease that's caused by people who inherit P53 mutations called Lee-Fraumeni syndrome. It's named after Lee and Fraumeni, who discovered it. And those people have, there's no penetrance problems. Those people have 100% chance of getting cancer over their lifetime. And in the worst situations, they get 5 cancers over their lifetime. Now, that almost tells you that these cancers are not life-threatening cancers because they keep cutting them. Well, they're watched very carefully. They keep cutting them out, they keep treating them, and they keep coming back with new cancers. And probably some of the treatment caused the subsequent cancers. But having said that, these people usually don't live. They have underwhelming amounts of P53. They don't live very 50, 60 years. They're no 80-year-old or 90-year-old leaf from any patients. I'm going to talk a little bit this afternoon that ties back again. How the P53 pathway has a big impact on fecundity. How stress has a big impact upon the number of offspring we're going to produce. We would predict, though it almost never happens, that women that have that mutation would have a lot of birth defects and probably not have much in the way of offspring. And in fact, almost all these mutations genetically are de novo. They're not inherited. Right? So that, I would think that there's a real problem of transmitting effective offspring. So to end up, that's a good way to end up. So P53 is a solution to a problem that has arisen in evolution all the time. Every single organism has developed extraordinary DNA repair processes because we're constantly bombarded. Our information base is constantly bombarded with this radiation and with chemicals and so forth, right? And somewhere around worms and flies, in evolution, P53 gets invented. Yeast don't have it, bacteria don't have it, right? Gets invented as an alarm system in response to DNA damage. And the place it's acting the most in flies and worms is in the germline. So if you take a fly and irradiate it, there's a wave of apoptosis in sperm. It kills off all the sperm. And then about a day or two later, if you did that in the mouse, the same thing happens. A wave of apoptosis in sperm takes the mouse about 20 days to make new sperm, takes the fly a very short time. After all the death, new sperm is made and it doesn't have the DNA damage. Right? So this is a fail. It starts off in evolution as a fail-safe against producing organisms which are, in fact, damaged and will use resources in the environment to prevent wild-type from flourishing. Right? That's back to the population level problem from the molecular level. But that's the reason why flies and worms seem to have it. Because I've told you that flies and worms are post-mitotic. They don't have a lot of stem cells. They have some. They have stem cells in their sperm and egg, but not a lot. And then this gets readapted in us because we constantly chose, we the mammalian or the vertebrate group, chose to regenerate our tissues rather than to, and give us a long lifespan. Right. And so this is a sort of a readaptation of something the flies and the worms have used in the germline, or mainly in the germline.